So Desiree, we're starting again. Desiree, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Wayne. How are you doing?
Tell me what's been happening in your life. I think I saw you about 6 years ago or more.
It was a long time ago, yeah.
And I know you've done some amazing stuff, so I just thought I'd selfishly call you in today and as a catch up and see what your life's been about.
Yeah, great. I've been doing so many different things. About 2 years ago, I decided I would start getting serious about my visual arts, and I've been pushing that pretty hard, going in sort of 100%, which was the first time in my life I've done that. And it's been really rewarding.
Pushing 100%?
Yeah. Well, I've pushed 100% before in other things, but not in my visual arts, which has always been sort of at my heart. And I sort of came to a point in my life where I thought about what I was doing and where I wanted to be in 20 years' time, 30 years' time, 50 years' time. And I was enjoying what I was doing, but I didn't want to, you know, I couldn't see myself at 50 doing that. So I really broke it down and I thought, you know, my visual arts is something that I've been passionate about since I was a kid. I come from a line of artists. My grandmother and I used to paint together all the time. I was like, that's the only thing that really makes sense to me. And it's something that I can do until, you know, I die. I can be a 90-year-old lady painting. And I also am very fond of being my own boss. So as a visual artist, you know, I'm my own boss.
Because didn't you study visual arts?
Yeah, I studied visual arts at both TAFE and university.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I studied set and costume design at WAPA as well. But, you know, I still never was all in. I played in bands in my 20s and did a lot of acting as well in my 30s and, yeah.
So it's because you were doing – it's probably because you were in your 20s and you were just trying to experiment with different things and, you know. Yeah. Do you know why you didn't go in 100% after studying in TAFE and college and after that?
Yeah, I do actually. Well, I was always, growing up, I was always told I was very good at it, you know, that I was talented and all this sort of stuff, which personally I think is, you know, absolute rubbish anyway. But I had this overwhelming pressure on myself, put on to me by me, to do beautiful things, you know, and that it had to be perfect. And I went to university and, you know, there was all this conceptual things, you know, and then I started to question, like, why am I doing this? Like, what do I want to talk about, you know? And
what have I got to share?
What have I got to share? And I mean, I was young and a little bit stupid, so I didn't really have the life experiences that gave me anything that I really wanted to talk about. And so this overwhelming pressure, the perfection as well, just crippled me. And I thought, well, if I'm not able to make what I want to make, then I'm not going to make anything at all.
Really? It was like that?
Yeah, basically.
I think that self-perfection destroys a lot of people.
Yeah, it does.
I actually made a film years ago and it was for a theatre company. And it was about, no one knew, but it was about my life. And the midsection of it was I found what I wanted to do, but I kept destroying the artwork before anyone could see it.
Yeah.
I was my own worst enemy, and it was called the Dream Destroyer that came in. It was an older version of myself. So as a kid, you don't have those inhibitions. You don't have that whether people are going to talk about it. You don't have that ego you do when you're an adult. And it meant a lot to me, but then I realised how much that actually destroys a lot of artists in different areas.
Yeah.
That self-perfection, that you're never good enough. And I think as you get older, you just stop caring what people think.
Totally.
You know?
If people hate my work, okay. If people love my work, okay. I'm not doing it for anybody else.
There's a freedom that comes with that.
Totally.
When did that happen? Do you know?
I think it happened about 2 years ago, and I can't put my finger on a particular, you know, catalyst for it. It just happened. I think I just got fed up, really.
Of what?
Just being my own prisoner. Like, yeah. it's so ridiculous. I just thought about it. And like I said, I was thinking about what I wanted to do. And, you know, to be anything else didn't make sense. And I was like, well, then you're going to have to get your act together, right?
Yeah. Did you stop everything else and just focus on your art? Or were you still dabbling in, I know you were doing acting and things like that?
I still do a little bit of acting. So I haven't stopped everything, but this gives me so much joy that I don't really, I'm not driven to other things.
And Desiree, you're fucking talented at it.
Thanks. It's all hard work. It's not about talent.
For the listeners that don't know, I actually had met Desiree. I was teaching a class years ago. I don't know how long ago it was. And when I saw her artwork on Instagram, I liked the artwork. So I followed this person, not connecting that it was the same girl that I'd known years ago. And it wasn't till recently, it was literally before I contacted you, I saw one of my friends that you had done a portrait of. And then I went, this girl's in Perth. I thought you were overseas. And then I realized I connected the Desiree Crossing to the Desiree that I knew a long time ago. That's when you were going out with another actor at that time. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, years and years ago.
That's what I mean. Yeah. So it was a long time ago and I just didn't connect it. But I did fall in love with your portraits because one of my favorite photographers is a guy called Steve McCurry. And he does portraits and he's famous for portraits. I'll show you the book a bit later.
Yeah, I'd love to see.
Your themes and your style of how you paint reminds me of the version of a painting version of Steve McCurry's photography.
Wow.
Which is why I connected with the portraits. So when it comes to themes, loss and solitude.
Yeah.
Tell me why.
I try not to delve too much into my own brain as to why I do things.
You don't want to destroy that magic.
Yeah, it's instinctive. You know, like I'll get a model in or a friend in or someone like that, and then we'll just play with some ideas, and it's always those ones that I'm drawn to. I think growing up I always felt very lonely, and I still do sometimes. I think that's normal, part of being human. And just recently, I've gone through some really tough times, and the visual arts is the only way I can kind of express little bits of that. I do like people to put their own meaning on my paintings, though. So I set up something that's meaningful for me, but something that might be a little bit vague in the specifics. So I like people to be able to see my paintings and think, oh, that makes me feel this way because of something that's happened to them, state that they're in.
Do you pick your subjects? How do you pick your subjects? Because, I mean, God, who wouldn't want to get painted? And who wouldn't want to get a portrait by Desiree? But what is it about the person that you see that you might, I'm interested in painting that face?
For me, somebody with life experience is more interesting to paint. And that's not necessarily age. Like I've painted some really beautiful young people that have just a little bit of something else going on that I can pick up on that intrigues me. So that's always really interesting. People, I've recently been doing portraits of some performing artists, and they tend to have, you know, something that drives them that I find interesting as well.
Do you often find out a little bit about yourself when painting others?
Oh, definitely. It's a very long process painting a painting.
Well, especially so, the way you do it. I've seen some of your movies that you've put on where you've done fine strokes.
Yeah.
And I think it was over the beard of Mo.
Yeah.
And talk about patience. And I'm trying to look at more, like I'm trying to look at the skin tones, but you were just focusing on the beard, and I thought, how long does it take you for one portrait, roughly?
Oh, that's a really hard thing to answer. Obviously, size plays a part in that. But for example, the one I painted of John Madd, I would have spent at least 100 hours on that.
Wow.
Yeah. But I enjoy every minute of it.
Well, that's all that counts.
Yeah.
Good friends of mine. There's a euphoria that comes with doing what you love.
100%.
And it's like a drug. And unless you've experienced it, you don't know what it's like. So when they talk about when they try to bring in money and things like that, I just keep saying you don't understand. It's what I would do all the time.
Yeah.
So what this gives me is what money cannot in that sort of sense.
Yeah, 100%.
So whether you spend an hour or 100 hours, you're enjoying that process.
And for me, my world can be crashing down around me. But when I'm painting, it all just fades away.
Therapy.
So I find, yeah, really, really cathartic and therapeutic and all those things. Yeah, it's a beautiful space. And when you're painting, every brush stroke is a thought. So everything that you are thinking while you're painting, that painting goes into it. And I think people can pick up on energy from art, how it's created, that sort of thing. Mm. All arts. So, yeah.
Do you remember the first ever painting or artwork you ever did as a kid?
I do know that I've been painting since I was tiny, and my my auntie had a it was a still life I did for her on her fridge until I was like maybe 30 or something like that. And I'd drawn it when I was 3, I think. And it was oil pastels, and it was of a vase with flowers and some fruit in a bowl. And I was looking at this thing, and I was like, I've done shadowing like underneath the vase and the bowl and things. And I was like, what kind of a 3-year-old does that?
It's inbuilt, don't you think? Yeah,
it's crazy.
I was talking to Steve Brown, and Steve said that when he was also 2 or 3, they would give him crayons. And he obviously had a method. He wasn't just like scribbling. He had a method to the crayon drawing, yeah, you know, and his dad picked up on it. But I think half the advantage there is being encouraged by your elders to,
for sure,
to push it more.
Yeah.
Because you said your grandparents or your parents were artists, or who was an artist in your family?
So my grandmother was really interested in the arts, and she wanted to pursue it as a career, but then she got married and had children, and that was her job then, and she wasn't allowed to pursue it. She came back to it when she was retired, sort of in her, would have been in her 70s maybe, in big way, 60s, 70s, and she really enjoyed it. But by that stage, you know, she hadn't been able to pursue it for so long. She'd sort of lost a bit of the magic that, oh gosh, I shouldn't say that on a public podcast. You know, she was heading in a direction, and, you know, that just got cut off, and then her direction went somewhere else. So, but her father was an artist, and I believe his father as well was an artist. Her brother was an artist.
Wow.
Beautiful cartoonist. My mother was actually really, really quite good at art as well, but she went blind. So that kind of put a dampener on that. But yeah, so growing up, mum was always encouraging, and I do remember spending a lot of time with my grandma, and in my early teens I'd go to art classes with my grandmother too.
So it was always there?
Yeah, always there.
What age did your mum go blind?
Oh, it's degenerative, so she's been going progressively blinder since she was a teenager.
Wow.
Mm.
And were they doing the same sort of art as you are?
No. No, my stuff has sort of evolved on its own.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you think it's evolved as you've evolved as a person?
Definitely. That's the nature of art, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think there's a lot to learn from one's darkness.
Yeah.
Because art is our therapy, so we do it that way. How did you come to going to Italy?
Oh, okay. So, I'd been saying I want to go to Europe. I'd been to Europe 20 years ago and lived there for a little while, and it was beautiful and, you know, the best worst of times, like, you know, travel like that is. And I'd been just feeling this drive to go to Europe, this big, big thing inside me, and I was like, I want to go back to Europe and spend some time there. And I didn't do anything about it. I was like, oh, I love my job and I love my dog and I love my house.
When was this?
This is about a year and a half ago, I would say. Yeah, so I was just contented with, you know, where I was and what I was doing, that sort of stuff. And then within the space of a couple of months, everything just crashed down on me. So lost my job, my dog died, I lost my lease on my house, and my sister died as well. So everything sort of
Your sister died.
My sister died,
That would have shaken everyone up.
Oh, it was...
That's horrible.
The worst, absolute worst thing that could possibly have happened to me or my family. And, you know, it's a big, long, deep issue there. But all these things happened and I just kind of... Can I swear on your podcast?
Well, I've sworn.
I was like, fuck it. I'm just, you know, like everything's just burned to the ground. So, like... fuck everything, I'm just taking off. When my sister died, she had some life insurance that came to me and just a small amount, but it was enough to get me to Europe. And I was like, okay, this is, for me, it was the world just saying, just go. And I did.
Do you still, in a way, feel your sister with you?
Yeah, of course. Especially in the first month or so, I really felt her very strongly.
Explain that.
It's really hard to explain, but just it would be like a warmth energy that would just come over me, and and it was very calming and things like that. And sometimes I would just think of things with her and like you know, or I'd see things that she would have loved and laughed at, and then I would think it was hilarious. I'd be laughing and laughing and laughing, and it's almost like I felt like she was there laughing with me or what have you. She was funny, very funny, and we shared a bit of a twisted sense of humor, and yeah, it was great. I had a couple of strange experiences. Like one night I was at home in my lounge room alone and everything was quiet, and then coming from the room next to me, the kitchen, I heard this bell ringing, and it was like ding, 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 ding. And I was like, what on earth is that?
Just a random bell?
Just a bell.
Did you have a bell in the house?
No, there were no bells. Nothing like that. And I was like, I just sort of froze and I was like, what on earth is going on? And then, and it was irregular as well. So it wasn't like a tap dripping on anything, and it was loud, and it just stopped. And I was like, on earth just happened? And then it started up again, and I jumped up and I ran into the kitchen. I could hear it and I could see where it was coming from. Well, you know, you could pinpoint where the sound was coming from, and there's nothing there. It was above the cabinets. There's nothing on the cabinets. And then as I was listening, the sound shot across the room, like beyond the cabinets. So yeah, quite a few meters over, and continued this like dinging sound. And that was probably a week or two after she died. I can't explain it, but I've never heard anything like that before or since, and it just felt like something more.
I hear that a lot, though.
Do you?
Yeah, I hear that a lot from even from previous guests.
Yeah.
You know, but we were talking about people's defining moment in their lives, and you know, often something beautiful stems from something tragic.
Yeah.
So with Steve, he broke his neck.
Yeah.
And he said it was a defining moment because that became his best friend. Mm. He realized time is of the essence and the minutes are ticking down. And I think we've all had that, because I don't think we'd be doing what we're doing now. See, I said mine was a dream, a repetitive dream I had. And I've had, around that time, I was surrounded by death from a lot of people I knew.
Wow.
And I knew that I just can't waste any time. I've got to do things that I want to do.
That's
and it. Be happy with that, you know. So obviously, you know, it was a tragic circumstance, but it allowed you to say, fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and be me for once, you know.
Absolutely.
How do you find the tragic death of your sister changed you? Like, who's the Desiree today compared to the Desiree before?
I actually think, if anything else, it made me feel like who I am, it strengthened my sense of self. And also, you know, I mean, it was such a tragic, tragic experience. Then I thought, if I can get through that, I can get through anything. Yeah, so things don't faze me like they used to. And that whole thing, like, you know, you and Steve have both experienced in, like, it could be over. It could be over tomorrow. Yeah. And like, what am I all up in my head about things for? I'm really wasting time. I could be creating things. I could be just living a simpler life. I think you spoke to me earlier about simplifying your life after your experiences. And I sold everything that I owned, gave it away, and I really wasn't planning on coming back to Perth, to be honest. And I lived out of a suitcase for a year. I realized how little I actually needed. It was really freeing.
It's very freeing when you do. I think, you know, there's that old saying that the things you own end up owning you.
Yeah.
So why did you come back to Perth?
I ran out of money.
Where were you born, by the way?
I was born in Perth.
Okay, so you're born here. Yeah. You've got no connection to Europe at all?
I am half Maltese, quarter Dutch. So we always had, growing up, the Dutch part of my family was a really strong influence. So my Omar and Opa, and my mum, like always, you know, used to have things like, my Opa was the Dutch consul for 20 years. So that was a big part of our life in a way. Yeah.
Tell me about Italy.
Oh my goodness. It's so beautiful.
I was a little jealous when I looked at some of the residents that you were, like there was one, I think, that was built by a grieving prince, and Salvador Dali apparently was there. Yeah. That garden. I mean, talk about inspiring.
I think it's called Il Sacro Bosco or something like that, the sacred woods. And I'm going to really like open myself up to, I'm a real nerd here. Good. So I was watching all these gardening videos. Yeah. On Netflix, and there's a guy called Monty Don, and he did Monty Don's Gardens of Italy. And so I'd been watching these because I love plants and gardening and things like that. And he went into this wood and I was like, this is incredible. This is the stuff of dreams, like fantasy kind of gardens. And these sculptures that they have in there are enormous. So I think you would have seen one where there was a giant eating a man.
Yeah.
That one there is... it's like two stories high at least. Like they're enormous. And the photos I took don't do them justice at all. And they just got lost for hundreds of years and were rediscovered at the beginning of last century. And I was like, could you imagine being the one stumbling upon those?
You know, I always think that. I always think that. Can you imagine like going through these overgrown weeds in this jungle, in this like foresty area?
Yeah.
And then coming across these sculptures that look like that.
And they're nightmarish. So many of them are nightmarish.
I know.
It was
But it's
fantastic.
Like from a different time.
Yeah.
And so was that a residency there or wasn't?
No,
that was
no.
Where you passed through.
That was a big detour I went on.
Because you hired a car in Florence.
I did, yeah.
And you didn't have any winter gear, if I remember?
What was the one
where it was like hailing and...
Oh, yeah. So we hired a car in Florence and one of my friends came to meet me and we hired a car and we drove up to Cinque Terre, which is beautiful. And it's all on these, you know, steep hillsides and things like that. We had this little Fiat 500 and I was going up. The roads up there are really, really windy and the fog was so thick that I couldn't see much further than that wall just there in front of me. And super windy roads. I was like, oh, my goodness, like driving like... not a snail's pace. I mean, I was in Italy, so you know. But it was crazy, and we couldn't really see Cinque Terre at all. We went down and, you know, stayed the night there. It was beautiful what we saw, but that was a really fun experience.
So you weren't alone; you were with somebody.
At that point, yeah, she came in. We spent a week together.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was really great.
It'd be a bit scary if you're alone driving in a strange country in winter and you can't see anything.
I would do that.
I would. Yeah. I've driven everywhere that I've gone to and it's such an adventure.
It is, isn't it? You see so many things that you wouldn't see otherwise.
And the fact that you can just stop whenever.
Yeah.
And take a photo and the worst place I've ever been to for traffic was Cairo.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
A lot of the cars had skateboard wheels attached to the doors.
What?
Because they kept crashing, bumping into each other. So there's no rules. And there was even a billboard, a friend of mine that took us around, he said there was a billboard that was erected there saying there's a new invention in the cars today and it's coming to Cairo and it's called indicators. And it was a piss take because no one uses them. And I drove in the desert there, but not in Cairo. I didn't have the balls to do that. But Europe's a whole different ballgame when you drive. But it is an adventure.
I had the best time. Like, I was, like, hooting down these highways in, like, going into Rome. There was this one freeway. It was 6 lanes wide and no lanes marked. Don't know why. Don't know if it was roadworks. And I was like, this is fantastic. Driving, you know, like, way over the speed limit because it's Italy and everybody does. And I was like, living my best life.
I know. I think half the adventure is driving.
Am I going to die today?
You know, my rule is if you're going in the direction, it's good. And just don't hit anything on the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And follow. Just follow other people, what they do, because it was my first time driving in and I was in Greece. But after a while, I thought, okay, I'm sort of getting it now.
Totally.
And it's just coming back here. You know, when I'm indicating, the windscreen wipers are gone because I'm doing the different thing.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So how long were you there for?
I was in Italy for about 4 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When?
From March through till June, basically.
Last year?
Yeah, last year. Oh, it was great. So great.
Are you going to go back?
Yeah, I think so. I hope to.
Or to a different country?
Well, I'm going to America next month, which will be really good.
You told me.
Yeah, really briefly. So I'm going over there. I've got a couple of portraits to paint in New York. And then I'm going to go – this is very exciting. I'm very excited about this. I'm going to do an apprenticeship with David Casson, who's, in my opinion, one of the greatest portrait painters alive.
Really?
Yeah. He's
so you're going to learn from someone you really look up to?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, what a blessing.
I get little goosebumps thinking about it.
What a blessing.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
Well, actually, I did a week-long course with David and his wife, Shana, last year at the beginning of the year. I drove to Adelaide and did a course there, and it was fantastic. I learned so much from them. And, you know, like David's words keep coming back to me every time I'm doing a painting. And that was in a big room with, you know, 35 other people, and I found it super rewarding. So I was just on Instagram. Oh, it's a funny story. I was on Instagram one night and I had seen that this other painter, who's a beautiful hyper-realist, was going to be doing workshops in New York about the time that I was going to be there. And I was like, yes, oh my goodness, yes. And I grabbed some cash from my house, and then I ran in the middle of the night down to the bank and put the cash in so I could go pay the deposit, and sat there outside the bank and tried to pay the deposit. And then I realized I didn't take into account the exchange rate because it's in US dollars and I couldn't afford it. And I was like, oh, you know, I wasn't going to go back home and, you know, put more money in right then, but I was sad. I was like, it's going to sell out. I'm going to be really sad. And woe is me. And then I walked down to my studio and I was like, it's fine, it's okay. And sat down in my studio, opened up Instagram, and then David had posted half an hour later that he was looking to take on a couple of apprentices. And I was like, oh, yes, yes. David's work is a little more in line with what I like to do.
Sure.
And
which is?
Just realism, but it's still painterly, you know. And well, the other guy is a realist painter. He's somewhat more of a hyper-realist. So it's a little bit more particular. But David's is a little bit more painterly, I suppose. Because I got so much out of that workshop with him before, I was like, yes. He also learned from one of, you know, the greatest painters of that guy's generation too. So it's like this exciting lineage of
this wisdom that's been passed down.
Yeah, and that really excites me. And so I messaged David and I was like, hey, David, like, can I come and do your, you know, an apprenticeship with you? And he said, yeah, man. he's a cool guy. He's
like, down to earth.
Yeah, dude, like, that was really fun. Like, come over.
Is that how he said it?
Yeah, pretty much in Instagram. Like,
how old is David?
I think he's about my age, actually.
Oh, so yeah. Still quite young.
Thank you, yes.
Okay.
Young for the work he's producing.
Right. Yeah. And he's been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
So what did you learn from David that you didn't know?
Well, I'm
in that room of 35 people.
Yeah, right? I'm a self-taught painter. So I studied art at, you know, ECU and TAFE and things like that. But pretty much it was all conceptual at university. TAFE, I had one lecturer, Jurek, who taught me a couple of little things that I found valuable, but for the most part, I'm self-taught. And we didn't touch oils at TAFE at all. Okay. So I learned a lot of technical things from David that were really great. And like, I feel like such a babe in the woods, you know, like when it comes to that sort of stuff, like honestly. And so to have some guidance was marvellous for me. And
what do you think you can learn a lot more on in the work you do? Like, what are your flaws in that work that you can improve on, do you think?
I really would like to improve the narrative in my paintings.
Okay.
That's something that really interests me. And I dabble in it a little bit, but I just haven't found that thing that is going to be my thing yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is truly Desiree.
Yeah.
This style. So yeah. If people look at it, they'll know that that is Desiree.
I think the style of painting
is there.
Is there, or at least the beginnings of it. But, I mean, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 5 years' time as far as painting goes, but I think it will include sort of stronger narratives.
Faces, to me, if I had to paint, I'd paint faces. Well, when I did photography, I did portraits because I think faces are just so interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, the ones that have been through a lot, experience, you know, especially the elderly. I used to, there was a saying that if you wanted to make money in photography when you're traveling, take pictures of the elderly and of little children early in the morning, because the elderly overseas just have this roadmap of their life on their face.
Yeah.
And there's a saying, the lens points both ways. So I said to you earlier, do you find out a lot more about yourself when painting someone else or little bits about yourself? What sort of relationship do you have with the subject? Do they give you a photo or do they sit there in front of you while you do? What's your process there?
So it depends on things like how much time I've got to sit with them. But for the most part, I always take my own photos. I'll usually bring them into my studio. We'll have a plan as to why we're doing this painting. Sometimes it is me bringing in a model. In those instances, it's usually because I have something in mind specific that they're right for, you know. If it's somebody that I'm painting as a portrait, say, for example, Mo or John, I have a reason for bringing them in, and I want to talk to them about, you know, sort of what my plan is for them. And we do have a bit of a chat beforehand and what interests me about them that I want to bring out in the portrait. So I like to make my subjects really comfortable as well. So we like with you, you know, we just have a chat, you know, and I chat with them while I'm painting them or while I'm photographing them. So generally, you know, they relax a little bit into it. And I find performers are great for that as well, actually.
Really?
You know, John and, you know, they're used to being around people and, you know, in unusual situations, I suppose. So, you know, they did relax into it very easily. Sometimes the people who aren't performers, like, take a little bit longer to get relaxed. But so then I'll take a series of photographs. I might try a few different poses and... but usually I have a pretty clear idea before they come in as to what we'll be doing.
Have you noticed your audience change over the time?
My audience change? I mean, my family probably represent a smaller percentage of my followers.
Yeah. So where do you see yourself in about 5 years from now?
Wayne, I have no plan.
I was, you know, I hate to say it, but I was hoping you were going to say that. Because when you said before, you 10 years, 20 years, I'm thinking you're focusing too much on what's not going to happen.
No, like I have no plan. I just know that that's what I want to be doing then. Where, how?
I don't know.
I'm just following the little trails. So, like I said, I'm going to America. That might open up some doors for me, might not. If it opens doors for me, I'll be ready to follow them. I'm not really attached to place, so I could come back to Perth that would be nice. I like Perth. I really do.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's nice when you go away. You know, if you're stuck here all the time and you're in a bubble, you know, you can't see the wood from the trees.
Totally.
But it's only when you go away, and sometimes the isolation can really work.
Yeah.
Like people say it's too isolated. I don't know. Like as I've gotten older, I was one of those kids that's like, oh, I hate this place. I want to get out. When I was young. But when I did move, I moved away from Perth when I was 23.
Yeah.
Stayed away for nearly 9 years. And then when I moved back, I was a bit more mature and I could understand what the pull is here and how it could really suit my life in that way. So, no, I understand. I understand that totally. I was going to say, I actually find it the reverse. So when I get performers on to talk to, especially actors, I find they have a very hard time being themselves. They're so used to escaping into characters and then get given that world that they have to be in and dialogue they have to speak. But an actor that has to be introspective on themselves without character, I found that to be quite difficult.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
It is. It is. And there's certain things, there's certain tricks that I'll do. So I'll branch in, like you have painting. So it's not like you're just an actor. Mm. But with an actor, I'll tend to talk about the craft and then from the craft how it affects them personally.
Mm.
And once they go to that personal space, then I'll branch and I'll start asking them questions about themselves. But I always have to bridge from performance rather than, Desiree, you know, who are you? Tell me who you are and that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
So I found that very hard.
I have a bit of a problem with professional models, actually. So professional models, I find, always trying to pose, you know, for, you know, like in a sort of glamour shot sort of way and or trying to be sexy. And I'm not, that's not my style of painting, you know. I want somebody to be real. That's really what interests me. So I do understand that from that aspect.
Yeah.
I have to like constantly push them to be like, just relax, you know, like, you know. I don't say just relax.
Yeah, but you just talk to them?
Yeah, just talk to them. And I think like you, I try and talk to them about sort of personal things that will just relax them a bit more.
That's half of it.
Yeah.
I know same in portrait photography. Mm. It's the same sort of techniques for them to be themselves.
Mm.
And there's different ways of how, that's half the art of photography is being able to communicate what you want if you're doing portraits, not landscape. But I love portraiture because I found out so much about people. And I, as a director directing, our biggest skill is observation. Awesome. And in acting, it's their biggest skill is listening. So as an observer when I travel, my wife and I play this game. We always look at somebody and we try and make up stories about what they're thinking. And we do that even down here in Leadable. We do, whenever we have a coffee, we'll look at someone and go, where have they just come from? What's their background? And we'll just build this story around them. And it's so interesting.
So much fun.
Yeah, seeing people in their own inner dialogue, just, you know, introspective. They're just thinking about their day and it's our job to question, okay, what are they thinking about? Where are they going? Where have they come from? You know, and Leadable is this, I suppose it's like Frio. It's this community where you see the same people all the time. And you find out more about the different people that come there and their lives, and especially the elderly. They've got amazing stories.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I'm going to be one of those people that go to retirement homes and just interview and take this podcast and do a podcast on their lives and where they've come from and things like that.
That would be fascinating.
I know. I asked this question the other day and I'll ask it to you. Where do you think that inspiration, when you're painting, do you believe that intuition, you know, when you just start going with it, comes from you or does it come from a wider consciousness?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. And I know a lot of people sort of believe that creativity is something like it's almost like an entity in itself that we invite in. And this is a very, very big question, right? I don't know that it matters, actually. I think people have a lot more power than they give themselves credit for, just in general. Whether something actually is internal or external, I don't think it matters. I think it matters what you do with it. So, or your ability to flow with it. I don't know if that answers your question. I know that if you nurture it, it grows.
I tend to, I ask that to all artists because you get different things.
Yeah.
Some people believe, I think we're tapping into, it's like stories are not, you know, they're just rediscovered. Mm. You're discovering stories that have already been told by the wider consciousness. It's just you're telling it in a different way because of your own experiences and things. Where some people just think, no, it's just totally me. It comes from my own life experience.
Yeah. Have you ever read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert?
No.
It's a book about the creative process, and she tells stories about different creatives that actually sort of receive their ideas actually like a train of thought, or somebody who receives it like the things they were writing, the poetry or the story, actually it comes, flows through them, and they have to grab a notebook to write it all down as the thing is traveling through them. It's interesting.
I've felt that a few times when writing.
Mm.
Like with a few commissioned screenplays, I did, one idea was about a tattoo artist that went into trances, and she would be up on stage because she was quite famous for it.
Mm.
And 3 hours later, she would snap out of it and this portrait would be, you know, painted or tattooed on someone's back.
Wow.
But it actually came from her dead grandfather that was trying to warn her about something. So, yeah, it was this intrigue sort of story. But a few times while writing that, I would write a page and then think, what have I just written? Mm. And I'd have to go back and read it. And I always used to question myself, like, I wonder, you know, were my hands being guided at that time, or was I so into the story that I was just dictating what I was experiencing? And I'm always trying to get back to that because, you know, they say to be truly in the moment, you're not thinking of one minute from now, you're not thinking of 1 second before, but you're truly in the moment. Like I'm here listening to Desiree and finding out about her world and her perceptions on the world. And I'm always trying to get to that because it's so hard to be in the moment now and then it's gone. Now I'm in a new moment. And it's practice. It's like, I think, a muscle that needs to be sort of nurtured, you know.
Definitely.
What do you think about what happens to us afterwards?
Oh, I don't have any clear belief system on that. I'm not scared of death. Like, you know, you tell me you're not scared of it either. And I know that I won't have regrets when I go. I've done good things with my time here. And the more time I have, the more good things I can do. But as far as afterwards, I like to think that we're part of a larger consciousness. I do think that there are so many stories about people having experiences with people who have passed or what have you. And I'm not sure if that's, you know, creations from our own mind, because our mind is incredibly powerful and we can do all sorts of strange things, or if they're exactly what they're coming across as. But I don't think everything is as it seems. No. I mean, I don't even know if we're here right now, you know.
It could be a simulation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Simulation theory is one of the most likely.
That scares the crap out of me, though.
I know.
Because then it's like, what is there, you know? Are we? I had a friend. The reason why I asked that is a close friend from high school. I caught up with him recently. Haven't seen him for 30 years. He grew up as a Greek Orthodox, very strict. Every weekend they would go. And his sister's son passed away when he was quite young. So I asked him the same question and he said, Wayne, ever since my nephew passed away, I think God's an arsehole. You know, he became angry about it. And that anger prevented him from even looking and asking more questions. And I found that, and that so easily can happen. But I think artists are a different breed of people. We tend to question, be a lot more introspective and think about things. It comes through. We have that time where a lot of people in their day-to-day work, they just don't actually have to go that deep.
No.
And in a way, that's a curse as well, because we're always trying to go in. And
they're probably really happy. Like, just
annoys the shit out of me. I hate people like that. Do you just, they just day to day. Yeah, you know, they come home, watch TV. I used to see my friends, and they used every time they'd tell me they're bored, and I'd go over there and they're just like watching TV and they're lazed, and I thought, God, I don't remember the last time I did that.
I know.
And I've never been bored.
No,
and
me
two,
neither.
There's always things to do. But yeah, they just, that's the life. And they don't know of anything else beyond that.
Yeah.
And so me trying to tell them, you know, what writing gives me, I mean, even podcasting, it's very hard because unless they've found, and I said, what would you do if you could do, if you woke up every day, what would you do for free? And it'd be surprising how many people don't know the answer to that.
I know, it shocks me actually because it, like you, it's never been something that I've always got something to do, you know.
Yeah.
And there's always, I find wonder in day-to-day things as well, you know, like I'll stop my car and stare at that sunset because those colours are just so incredible. Or, you know, like just finding pleasure in those tiny things. But
it's the things you get for free.
Yeah, absolutely. And
wow. So where in America are you going?
So I'm going to New York first. I might go up to Maine as well. One of my subjects is in Maine.
Stephen King.
That would be cool.
Imagine doing Stephen King's portrait.
That would be great.
Oh, come on, Desiree.
Get your act here,
Let's make it happen. I'll send him this little clip of this podcast. I'll send it to him. I've got some funny stories about Stephen King, but yeah, so you're going to Maine's apparently beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I have a friend that lives near there as well, so it might make sense for me to go there too. And then the apprenticeship will be in Albuquerque.
Oh.
Yeah, New Mexico, so that will be something completely different.
It's very different.
Yeah.
So you're going from a Woody Allen film, you know, not new. I'm talking about Manhattan and, you know, the old classic Woody Allen films, into a Stephen King film.
Yep.
Then into Breaking Bad or something.
I think that's the only thing it's famous for, really.
But how interesting. And you've never been to America? Have you been to America?
I've been to America before, yeah. I didn't travel extensively. I went to Los Angeles, New York, and Las Vegas as well.
Oh.
That was it, yeah.
I love New York.
Yeah, New York's great.
Yeah.
I was really excited about going to Los Angeles. Didn't vibe with LA very much.
I didn't.
Didn't like Las Vegas at all and thought New York was the best place ever.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I think you either, like with the West Coast, I think you either love it or you don't like it.
It felt so contrived to me.
Pretentious.
The people felt so artificial.
Yeah.
And in York, actually, people were way friendlier. I don't know.
Do you know, whenever I see a big city, and I'm not saying Los Angeles isn't, I like to know there's history and a bit of grunge to it.
Yeah.
Like when I go to some of these cities in Asia, somebody said the other day, it's like I listened to a podcast and they said they're like snow globes with a death sentence. But it's too sterile.
Yeah.
These cities are too sterile. In New York, you can just go there and you feel the history. But you feel, shit, I could be mugged.
Yeah.
Or at the same time, I could have the best food ever and meet the best people ever.
It feels like the kind of place where anything can happen.
Yeah.
Really, like honestly, anything could happen.
That melting pot.
I had actually amazing experiences in New York. I was just traveling around, just chatting to people, and people were like, here, have some free tickets to, we'd be chatting to a cop who's like, oh, my friend's like, you know, running the ferry or whatever and gave us like free tickets to the Ellis Island, like ferry and Statue of Liberty and all this kind of stuff. And then people were like giving us free food and like we got into the David Letterman show. And
oh, did you?
Yeah, we just had like a really good time, but it wasn't so great for me in the other two places. I ended up staying in the hood by accident in Los Angeles.
When you say the hood.
The hood. That's how it was described to me. So that's, I'm passing this on. I'm really bad. I don't plan things enough. So I rocked up to LA with no accommodation or anything like that. Saw this notice on the airport saying free airport, like, you know, pick up to go to this backpackers. And I was like, sweet. And I was staying in Inglewood. I was just walking around Inglewood, because that's what I like to just wander. Everyone saw me just like stopped and stared at me. Like I really didn't belong. And me being me, I was just like, do, 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 do. And then like, oh, and all these guys on the street like, hey. And I'm like, hi. Went into like the CVS and people are just like literally stopped in the aisles and
Really?
Yeah. And
so you're that obvious, you're out of place.
Yeah. And then I went to Subway and it's like the pianola stopped playing.
And no. I was like, are you serious?
Strange. Yeah. And then and they're like, here's your change. And I'm like, thanks. And then I was like, oh, like I haven't seen one other white person here at all. And, you know, like I'm, you know, a slight white girl, like doo doo doo. And when I went to pay for the backpackers as well, I was like, yeah, can I just pay for two nights, please? And she goes, look, hun, just pay for one night, see how you go, okay? I was like, okay. And she's like, I'm going to try and not put anybody else in the same room as you, okay? And, like, she was really worried about me, and I didn't understand why. Had no problems there, but like, it was just strange.
Ignorance vibe. Is bliss sometimes. And, do you know, a friend of mine was the same. He walked around some of the worst neighborhoods, and yeah. He was this white Australian guy with, a Cobra hat. And he had a guitar on his shoulder. And he said, do you know how much you get away with just by having a guitar on your back? One of these black guys came up to him and said, look, mate, I know you're not from around here, but I don't know if you know how much danger you could be in. He goes, yeah. And as soon as he found out he's Australian, they said, oh, this guy is obviously lost. And when they spoke to him, they knew he was an Australian. And I think everybody likes Australians overseas. Mm. That he got away with so much by going over there, and sometimes that ignorance is bliss. Yeah. I was in Harlem in 2001, and what's worse with my skin colour is they mistake me as Puerto Rican or Mexican.
Ah, right.
So when Fern and I walked through there, they were like, what the hell, you know, because there were just black people. Mm. But we loved it. Like, we were going, oh, look at this. We're going in the market. We went to this place called Sylvia's to eat soul food. Like, I never had collard greens. I never had cornbread. Come on, bring it on, bring it on. But because we were just, and Fern and I saw the elderly. It was on a Sunday, and I think they were dressed in their church gear. But all of them were sitting under a bridge on trash cans. And I just looked at Fern and my sister, and I said, do you want to go talk to them? She was like, yeah. Do you know, we were walking up and we didn't look, you know, we weren't dressed up or anything. And you could see them all just suddenly go on the defense.
Oh.
And behind the elderly were all these young guys. And the minute we started talking, we're like, oh, we're from Australia. We're just wanting to see, you know, find out more about you guys and the people and come say hello. You could see their face just going, this is weird, you know. These strangers are just coming up and saying hello. After that, he was talking about Vietnam, being in the war, meeting Australians in Vietnam, and we all got on. And it was just, you know, and I said to him, we don't really see colour.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, from where I've grown up. And yeah, I do know there's problems here, but they were very well versed with the politics of what was happening, especially with the immigrants and the refugees being kept offshore on the boat. But I said, you know, I'm foreign and all my friends are foreign, so we don't really see that. But we had a ball, even though September 11 happened when we were there.
Oh, right, while you were there.
Yeah, we were there a week before September 11 and a week after.
Wow, that must have been an intense time to be there.
Six blocks away we were.
Oh yeah, I think I heard you talking about that.
A film of mine was being premiered there on September 11, 2001, 6 p.m. at the Clearview Cinema. Ooh. And I was looking forward to that date for like months. And obviously so nothing strange. Went ahead. Yeah, and again, it sort of prioritised what was important.
Mm.
You know, we still look back on that today because we were on our way to the World Trades that morning to go to the lookout. And something looked after us because my wife never sleeps in. She will get up early. She's the organised one, where Fern and I are like, let's go play pool till 3 in the morning. That's what happened. And my wife slept in. She didn't even go out. She stayed home so she could get up. She slept in 1 hour. So we got up in a rush and we were wanting to get down there because we wanted to skip the queue. It was the most surreal experience because we walked out onto the main road and all the cars had stopped and you could hear the wind.
Yeah, well, I had a really similar experience to you when I was in Las Vegas, and I just went wandering off the main strip in Old Vegas looking for a pair of cowboy boots. And I realized, like, I was getting into this more industrial area the further I went, and there was some guy following me. I'm sure he was following me. And people were pulling over in their cars saying, hey, do you want to ride? And I'm like, no, thanks. Kept walking. And
so you didn't go, yeah, like you did in Los Angeles.
And I was like, this guy's definitely following me. So I crossed the road and I stopped and I looked in a shop window and he walked past me and I was like, oh, thank goodness, you know. And then I went and I crossed the road back to this, there was an op shop over there. So I crossed the road back to the op shop and this guy crossed the road to meet me at the front of the op shop. And he just started like, you know, going like, you know, come home with me. Like, I'm going to make it big on MTV and I'd hate for you to see me on there and say, oh, I should have been fucking with him and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, do you have a, you're married, you have a boyfriend? I'm like, I have a boyfriend. And he's like, well, there's no ring on that finger, so you know what I'm saying, he ain't serious and all this kind of stuff. And I was just like hassling me. I said, leave me alone, like, just back off. And the whole time there was this enormous black dude covered in tattoos just watching. He was behind a rack of clothes just watching.
Sort of knew he had your back?
Yeah, and he I got rid of the other guy after some some trouble, and I went into the shop and this black guy came up to me and he goes, you are not safe here. I don't know what you're doing here, but it's really unsafe. You need to get home, like, leave now. And I was like, you know. He's like, no, I'm serious, like, please, I will walk you to your bus stop, like, let's go. And I was like, there was something about him and I just trusted him. And and I went with him, and he was walking with me and had me like on the inside of the footpath, and still guys are, you know, pulling over in cars and like, you know, harassing me. And he's like, just, I know it's during the day, he said, but you know, it's really unsafe, this area. And then we just got chatting, and he was just this beautiful guy, like, who just decided that, you know, he saw someone lost and I needed help. And he walked with me to my bus stop and he waited with me for my bus for about 40 minutes. While we were there, another guy came up and he said, this is my friend Desiree. I want you to look after her. Tell her which stop she needs to get off and don't let her talk to any of these other, like, you know, just tell her where she needs to get off and point her in the right direction to catch her next bus, okay? You look after her for me? And the guy's like, yeah, yeah. And they did some gangster handshake and stuff like this. And then when the bus finally came, he gave me a big hug and he said, I'm going to miss you.
I was really?
Like, I'm going to miss you too. He was just such, like, it was like an angel, you know, had been sent my way to look after me. And then I got off the bus where the guy told me to get off and I only had to walk one block to my next bus stop, and a whole car of these, like, real rough guys, like, actually blocked my where I was walking and, like, trying to get me in the car and that sort of stuff. And I was like, I was by the stage, I was really worried. And I walked into a service station and the girl was just like, what are you doing here? It's not safe for you to be here. Like, you need to get out of here. Yeah. And even in the service station, I was being like harassed and that sort of stuff. And I said, can you please call me a taxi? Taxi came, locked all the doors and like, what the hell are you doing out here? People like wind up in dumpsters all the time out here. It's calling me was the best thing you did today. And then I went back to my hotel and like looked and watched a Jake Gyllenhaal movie, and I was like,
isn't that weird? It's a whole new experience.
Yeah.
That, because we just take that for granted in Australia.
Yeah, right.
Like, you could go anywhere, even in unpleasant areas.
Yeah.
But the first thought that comes through your mind is not murdered or raped.
Exactly.
You know, you could be mugged. You could get, you know, hassled on the street.
Mm.
Even mugging would be like further from our mind.
Yeah.
But there are places in the world that, like New York. We were staying at an Airbnb and the guy goes, look, we know you guys are going around everywhere to my sister and I, but, you know, don't catch this train after dark. And it suddenly hit us, we're not in Australia anymore. And we're sitting there going, oh, okay. He goes, look, maybe nothing will happen. However, it's best not to catch it after dark.
Yeah.
Because you're quite naive, you don't know, you know, the streets, and you don't know things that can happen here. And that's when suddenly we're like, oh yeah, we're in New York again. But that sounds ridiculous. What, in Las Vegas?
In Las Vegas, yeah, in Old Town. I didn't realize how dangerous it was. It was broad daylight, and I spoke to a couple of locals later and they're just like, oh, girl. But hey, there's someone looking out for me.
Nothing like that in Italy?
I had a really awful experience in Italy, actually. You? Yeah. I don't want the podcast to turn into this sort of stuff.
No, but, no. Yeah. No, but it's more about travel and people can learn from that. I've heard some horror stories from Italy. We didn't really get any. We had a great time there. But I do know some female friends that were hassled quite badly in Italy.
Yeah, so I had that hire car and I dropped it off in a town that was a couple of hours from where I was staying. And then I couldn't get any public transport from that place to where I was meant to be going because it was a tiny town that I was staying in. And one of my friends in Rome had said, look, there's this rideshare service which is kind of designed for longer rides called Blah Blah Car. And he's like, it's really common to use that here. It's, you know, safe for that sort of stuff. So I was like, great. There was a guy traveling from the city to a town right next to where I was staying. And there was another girl sharing the ride as well. So booked that one in. I was really happy. And I'd been texting the guy for pickup and that sort of stuff in Italian. I met the guy and the girl in the car and it was very clear to them very quickly that I didn't speak much Italian. And she spoke a little bit of English. And she's like, he wants to know, like, how much Italian you speak. And I said, not a lot. She said, he wants to know how you've been texting him. I was like, Google Translate. So then she was relaying all the information to him. About 20 minutes into the ride, she gets dropped off. And he's like, turn to me in the back. And he's like, come into the front. And I was like, okay. Like, you know, I don't want to be rude or anything like that. He was this huge dude, military guy. He had that on his profile. And we pulled out from where we dropped her off straight onto the freeway, traveling at like 120 Ks an hour. And he locked the doors and then he started to masturbate in the car.
What?
I know. And so
The driver,
as he's driving, as I'm locked in the car.
God.
I know. And I started to obviously get really angry with him. And I'm like, stop, like, you know, and the angrier I got, the more into it he got. And then like, I just started to lose my shit and he ended up, like, yelling at me too, like, you know, like, and then he was, like, really into it because I was so angry and so upset with him and that was obviously a real turn on for him and I ended up, like, just, I was too crazy to control so he just pulled over on the side of the road and dumped me out of the car, which is what I wanted. I didn't want to spend a minute more in that car with him. And then I found myself in the middle of nowhere in the south of Italy. I didn't have enough language to call a taxi. Didn't even really know where I was. And I was really, like, I was just, like, crying. And then I called a friend of mine that I'd met in a town a couple of nights before. And I said to him, I don't know where I am. This has just happened to me. And, like, can you please call me a taxi or something? Mm-hmm. And so he was mad. And he organized a taxi to come pick me up and had me, like, Googled, screenshotted my location and sent it to him, and then I phoned another friend of mine in Rome and I said, this has just happened to me, and he's like, what the hell? And he's like, go to the police straight away, like right now, go straight to the police. And he's like, put the taxi driver on. And the taxi driver got on the phone, he didn't speak any English, and my friend said to him, I need you to take Desiree to the police station. You need to tell the police that this has happened to her, you know, this sort of stuff. And the guy did. So I rocked up at the police station, like, really upset, and the police told me to come back the next week.
I've heard that about the police. Yeah.
And my friend from Rome, he got on the phone to the guy in charge of the police station, and they were talking for like 15 minutes, and the policeman was admiring himself in the mirror the whole time as he was talking to my friend just like this. You know, just stroking his chin, you know. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And anyway, so my friend was like, that guy's a dickhead. And he's quite high up in the military himself, and he ended up phoning some people and spoke to the head of the police in Italy. He's like, these guys have been told that if they don't sort this out straight away, that they're all going to be, like, moved off. And so within, like, an hour, I had a translator and, you know, that sort of stuff, and an appointment booked for me for the next day. So I came in, gave all my statements, identified the guy because I had his phone number, so I could find who he was on Facebook and all this kind of stuff. And they're like, you know, he's not going to get away with this, you know, that sort of stuff. Well, it's been nearly a year and nothing has been done. And it really concerns me. I got away from it fine. I know that it's because he thought that I was a vulnerable person with my lack of language there. But I don't think of myself as a vulnerable kind of personality type. So if it had been somebody else in that car, who knows what might have happened. And, you know, like I'm in my late 30s. If it had been some, you know, 19, 20-year-old girl, naive, you know. I don't know what would have happened. And it's for those people that we need to stand up for ourselves, especially, you know. I mean, I shouldn't have had to have dealt with that.
No.
But there are people that might not have gotten out of it as easily as I did. And also, I mean, if he had decided that things were going to go differently that day, for me, he was so big and we're in an isolated part of the world, then I probably wouldn't have come out of it so easily.
That's when you needed your angel, the big black guy that you met over there.
Oh, I miss him.
It does show you there are good people out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are good people out there. And unfortunate, you know, there's unfortunate things that happen to you on travels. I mean, we've had that, especially in South Africa.
I always say, like, when you go on these sorts of adventures, they're always the best and worst of times.
Yeah.
And they really test you as a person. And they're always times of growth.
Yeah, I know. I know. And it's funny when you do think about those times that could have been that sliding door that could have easily gone that way.
Yeah.
And it didn't. It went this way. But it just makes a good story to tell for you and I. But then again, there could be a young girl listening to this podcast going to Italy.
Yeah.
At least now she'll have a wits about her a bit more. You know, you don't get swept up in that whole, you know, Italy and romance. Yeah. There are two sides to all of that.
Definitely.
And I think you should be aware of that, you know. I was expecting a lot more when I was there though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was expecting a lot more hassles and we went off peak though. Mm. We tend to travel off peak in, you know.
Good idea.
In the winter and, you know.
There's definitely a marked difference between now and when I went 20 years ago. It was a lot worse when I was there 20 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You're just walking around the streets in Rome and things like that. So it's good, but they're still a little behind.
But, you know, all the history.
Yeah.
So Desiree, where can people search for you online?
I'm most active on my Instagram account, which is just Desiree Crossing. And I also have a Facebook account, which is devoted to my art, which is Desiree Crossing Artist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And when are you going to America again,
That'll be April.
In April?
Yeah.
Oh, not long at all.
I know, nice and soon.
And how long are you there for?
Not sure. See how
it goes. That's right. What a way to live.
I know.
I love that though. I love that.
It's so much fun.
Yeah. And that could just take you to somewhere else and take you to somewhere else.
Who knows?
The one thing that you do know is that you've got to keep doing your art.
Yeah. I love it.
You've got to keep doing it. Like Steve, I was talking to Steve and I said, you know, the one thing that frustrates me is that you're talented at a lot of things. But I just want him to keep doing his art because I just know I love his art so much. But, you know, he said, look, everything is art, Wayne. You know, when I do filming, I'm painting with light. I'm doing the same sort of thing. And you can't argue with that. You're like, yeah, that's true. But I'm really proud of you. And now I know that you're the same girl as I knew years ago. I'm even more proud.
It's so funny.
Well, I hope to hear from you still and I wish you all the best coming up.
Thank you, Wayne. Thanks so much for having me on.
No, thanks for coming. Those that are listening, there was a massive storm today. And Desiree came running to my door like this destitute artist in a foreign country, soaking wet. This poor girl, she's come out in the middle of, you know, the week to do a podcast. So we thank you for that. Thanks, Desiree.
Thanks, Wayne.
Okay, bye.
Bye.